our final speaker of the day, one to whom I believe each of his five predecessors has alluded to, is, and if David Somerville didn't, he should have, is Hernando de Soto, native of Peru. Many in the Philadelphia Society, of course, are familiar with his work in examining Peru's informal sector, underground black market, or off-the-books economy, and equally importantly, the government bureaucracy that it is up against. Mr. De Soto is a Peruvian businessman who has served his country as governor of its central bank. He has also served at the GATT in Geneva. It was in Geneva, by the way, that he received his university-level education in economics at the University of Geneva and in law and economics at the University Institute of Higher International Studies. In 1979, he created a stir by inviting 20 street vendors to a symposium on democracy and the market economy, to which were invited such noted free market intellectuals as Friedrich von Hayek and well-known small-D Democrats as Jean-François Revel. A similar enterprise, after founding the Institute for Liberty and Democracy in Lima to study the bustling informal economy, he engaged college students to do what it took to set up small businesses and to register with the government. And remarkably enough, after about 1,000 days of such activity, his college students set up a functioning public transportation company in Lima. He is the author of a book that is widely known, especially well known in Latin America, where it is sold out in virtually every country, where it has been offered for sale. It's well known by its Spanish title, El Otro Sendero, The Other Path, its subtitle being The Informal Revolution. It is out in an English translation. He's had remarkable influence on intellectuals throughout Latin America, including in his own country. Many have noted the evolution of the thought of the well-known literary figure, Mario Vargas Llosa, toward free market and democratic interests. Mr. De Soto has played no small role in the education of such figures. And part of the evidence for that is that Mario Vargas Llosa, I think, won a Nobel Prize for literature, am I right? No? Well, he should have. Certainly has won a number of French and Spanish and Latin American prizes in literature and is one of the foremost literary figures of South America. Has taken upon himself to translate into English some of Mr. De Soto's economic work. The largest television station in Mexico has recently done a special on Latin American informal economies and black markets and on Mr. De Soto's work. His work, that book, The Other Path, his corpus in its aggregate is one of the greatest challenges to communist and other left-wing thinking in Latin America. His provocative thoughts are in no small measure challenges to those of us who are free marketeers elsewhere in the world as well. And here, right now, coming to our stage, having sat below it to avoid the draft that we're feeling up here, is Hernando de Soto.
I'll try and keep it short. I've been struggling all along while I've been hearing all these kind references to our work in Peru with trying to tell those of you who don't know what we're about, what we are about, on the one hand, and all those who have heard me before, trying to find out how I tell you something new and not to bore you. I think the first way to start, noticing that here in the Philadelphia Society was an invitation I thank that you are a society which believes in this interchange of ideas and not necessarily in conformity, that I don't think that the failures that we have seen in Latin America and that have been pointed out by my Latin American colleagues, in fact, are due to the fact that the Monroe Doctrine or the Reagan Doctrine isn't being applied. I think they're mainly the result of our own problems in Latin America, of course, in many cases enhanced by the wrong policies in the United States, but essentially our own problems, because I don't believe that the USSR or totalitarian ideologies could have a foothold in Latin America if we were in fact democracies and market economies. I think in that sense what Mr. Monterroso had said is absolutely right. We look like democracies. We have some of the trappings of democracy, and we have some of the trappings of market economies, but the reason we fail is because we're not there yet. And there's competition as to see which of the roads we actually take. To point this out, it is that we have rooted our studies in the case of the informal economy. Our question has always been, if there is an informal economy, what is it due to? If there is entrepreneurship, why does this entrepreneurship take place underground? Why isn't it overt? Why isn't it open? Because as Alejandro Chafuen pointed out, they are in Argentina, it's 60% of gross national product. In Peru, it's 40%. Supposedly in Colombia, it's 53% of GNP. But in total, about 50 to 60% of the population of Latin America seem to be working the so-called black markets. And by studying this black market is that we have come out to conclusions that the reasons essentially that market economies have not come into being and democracies don't work in Latin America are of an institutional sort, are of a legal sort. We have found out that, for example, in Lima, 50% of our cities have been built illegally. This is the only really hardcore study that I think exists throughout the world. It's the value of our homes, they are built illegally, are about $9 billion, more than half the external debt of Peru. 95% of our transport system, of our bus and taxi system, is informal. That is to say, it's illegal, it's private and it's illegal. Of the 331 markets that exist in Lima, 51 have been built by the state, and 257 have been built by the state, and 274 have been built by former street vendors of the private sector. So there seems to be a large, very powerful black market working not only in Peru, but as our book has sold throughout Latin America and the figures have started coming in, it seems throughout all of Latin America. So it is not true that there are not private forces in Latin America, nor should I say democracies, because all of these people are organized in informal political bodies, which are democratic by nature, since there's no way to enforce or coerce anybody into what the leaders want. They actually make decisions democratically. So we do have a grassroots democratic movement in Latin America, and we do have a burgeoning market economy, but it is all illegal. Now the question we asked ourselves was, why? Why does this occur? And what we started doing was measuring the cost of the law. But the cost of the law, seen from the point of view of not a person like myself, but of a person who actually comes from the more popular sectors in Peru, the poor, the so-called informals. So one of the first experiments most of you may have heard of is the one of the industry when we set up in Lima a small workshop in the outskirts of town with two sewing machines. And we put in there one lawyer and four of his assistants with a stopwatch to try and measure the amount of time it took him to be able to operate legally, to be able to start up operations without anybody's assistance from the formal sector. And we drew a PERT, of course, to trace all the steps he had done, and all his people went from window to window. And working 6 hours a day, it took 289 days to register. We did the same experiment in Tampa, Florida, and it took 3.5 hours. We recently finished in New York, and it took 4 hours. In other words, a proven entrepreneur has to work at that level 700 times more than a U.S. entrepreneur to set up the same industry. In terms of housing, when we repeated all these similar experiments, it turned out that if somebody wants a home in Lima and happened to be below the poverty line, which is a case of 70% of the population, so it's a case of the majority, the people that the communists generally mobilize, it takes to do it legally, the adjudication process, that is, 6 years and 11 months working 8 hours a day. During that time, whoever heads a supposed group of 100 families who wants a sand dune will have to fill in 207 different documents and visit 52 government offices, which is the reason, of course, why in 1985 there were 274 invasions of land in Lima, totaling more than 207,000 people. That's 200,000 people, and only 3 legal adjudications. The case for the street vendors, which we have also measured, between the time they actually organize on the street, get their savings together to build a market, and the time that they are allowed by the law to put the corners zone is 13 years. In other words, what we have been able to measure case by case is not that there is a lack of entrepreneurship, is not that there is a lack of democracy, but it's that the law is against entrepreneurship and democracy, and especially of the entrepreneurship and the democracy of the poor. Now, we have also found out, of course, that it's not only into entering the market, but it's also once you are in the market. When we have studied 38 small enterprises with less than 5 laborers each, and found out the cost of being legal, the amount of dollars or the amount of local entities that they have to pay to government, including all sorts of costs, it turns out that of every $7 paid to government, only one is in the form of taxes. The other 6 are in the form of bribes, in the form of social costs, and in the form of red tape bureaucratic costs. This, of course, also affects the formal sector. We must, in different degrees, work also within the system of corruption. We found out, of course, that it's not only a question of bad laws, it's also a question of the lack of good laws. There are no good property rights, as Alex Shafran pointed out before. We have seen that we saw 2 pueblos jóvenes. These are 2 young towns or shanty towns in Lima, one being very prosperous, Mariscal Castilla, and the other one, Daniel Alcides Carrion, being very poor, and told ourselves, well, obviously the more prosperous one indicates that these are people from the Andes who have come from a more rich region or more cultivated region, and Daniel Alcides Carrion, obviously from a poorer section of the Andes. Well, what occurred is that we were told by our advisors, people who had been working in the Ministry of Housing for many years, that they both actually came from the Andean village. So we studied both of these young towns, as we call them, closely for about 1 year and came out to the following conclusions. First of all, they did come from the same Andean village. They started off on equal footing. The difference was that while the mayor of Mariscal Castilla dedicated his time to obtaining property titles, the one of Daniel Alcides Carrion dedicated himself to internal organization. The man who dedicated himself to property titles continually changed the name of this town to be the one of the wife of the current president of Peru, and gradually obtained the favor of politicians and obtained the titles. 10 years after obtaining the titles, the value of homes in Mariscal Castilla, where you could see the televisions on through the curtains and the windows and the Toyotas and the Volkswagens parked downstairs, was 41 times greater than the one of Daniel Alcides Carrion. So yes, there is a need for land reform, but as the previous speaker pointed out, it is a need to actually secure property rights, not want to destabilize them. The same thing for contracts. Just to give you another summary idea, don't want to be definitely a long speech. We looked at the informals, we found out they had none of the good law, not only that bad law we've seen before. They have no long-term contracts. They have no economies of scale. They have no business organizations. They have no limited liability. They have no perpetual succession. Now you may say, well, how important is this? So I could extend myself for a few hours on this, but just let me give you one example that I think will illustrate it. No business organizations. As you know, entrepreneurship is all about pooling resources together. You can get people in Japan who don't have coal and don't have iron, yet they can produce some of the most efficient steel in the world because they know how to pool their resources together, how to combine them. Well, what will actually happen, and this is a true case, but I will use 2 names here, my own and that of Mr. Chafwin, to illustrate what actually happens to some Peruvian in the informal sector, and I'm sure to a Guatemalan in the informal sector, that is to say, for those who are, for the majority of the citizens of our countries. If I'm producing buttons, and I'm a very good button producer, and I have a little button producing machine in Peru, my problem is how to sell those buttons. And it just so happens that Mr. Chafwin is known as the best button seller in Lima. So the logical thing for us is to pool these resources together. Now, Mr. Chafwin's wife will tell him Okay, you must be very careful with DeSoto. Because when you're going to work with DeSoto, after 1 year or two, he'll know who you're selling to. And since you've got the machine, and he's got the machine, he'll be taking over all of the resources. Now, we were formal, which is, of course, very difficult, because remember, it takes 289 days. And that, and who can spare 8 hours during 289 days? We can't make that agreement. But if we did, we know that we would set up a business corporation and we would distribute both risks and profits. He would have, say, 30% of the shares or 40% of the shares, depends what we negotiated upon. I'd have the remainder. And no matter what I did, he'd have to be my partner in that specific business. His property rights, his contractual rights are insured. Since he cannot, in effect, come to that agreement, takes 289 days, we said before, he'll have to work with someone his wife trusts, and I'll have to work with someone my wife trusts. And that, of course, will be immediate family. So we won't have pooled resources of what will probably be, would have been Lima's most efficient button company. He'll have to go on his own, selling very well, but probably producing mediocrely. And I have to go on my own, producing very well, but probably selling mediocrely. As a result of which, some anthropologists from the United States will come and visit us and say, Latin Americans love to work in small family units. And that is exactly what you do. All your assistance to Latin America, a lot, great deal of your assistance, is involved in micro-enterprise programs. You finance only small enterprise through AID. What you do, for example, that is a little bit like going to Ethiopia and finding fit, skinny little people and then training tailors to make suits for skinny little people instead of handing them out. Because you've considered that our cultural characteristic. And it's not our cultural characteristic. Remember, we were known for the Spanish Armada. We were known indigenously for having created very large pyramids throughout Latin America. There is no actually proclivity of Latin Americans to do things small. On the contrary, there's a privilege to do things big. It's not true that we have a cultural problem in that direction. Now, I'd like to make a little interruption here to give you a practical, because I think it's really worthwhile, a practical experience of what this actually means, basing myself on what was said by most of the people who have preceded me in this podium, which is that the best thing is not to assist us, that the best thing is not to give us finance. The best thing is that we actually run out of resources so that we are not able to continue socialism. Okay, let me give you an idea. We came out, we studied for about 30 months up until the 21st of January of 1988, this year. We studied for about 30 months a way of getting credit to the poor, because the constituency, you must remember, are the poor. They're the majority of Latin Americans. And we said that it was, of course, a problem, that there were various problems to get credit to them. But the reason they did not get credit from the commercial system was, one, because of operational reasons. It is, of course, very difficult to give $50,000 of $100. It's much easier to give 100 loans of $50,000. Secondly, there's an enormous amount of red tape involved in the capital markets. I haven't recited that to you, but just believe me, there's an enormous amount. And third, of course, there's a credibility problem. Credit is all about credere, whether you trust somebody or you don't. When you have to give credit massively, you can't evaluate everybody. You've got to go on their resources, on their guarantees, on their collateral. So our whole question was, how do you collateralize the value of what the informals have been doing, the majority of Latin Americans? Mm-hmm. Considering that in Argentina, they produce 60% of GNP, considering that probably for the rest of Latin America they produce anything from 40 to 50% of GNP. And here you have 40% of GNP on the one hand, and here you've got the banks on the other, and there's no bridge between them. So we said, well, what's lacking are the right institutions. Now, a lot of the goods on the side of the informals happen to be real estate. That's unmovable. That's something you should be able to somehow or other get together. So we started, first of all, going down the road of saying, how can you title quicker? Because in Peru, in average, the titling of land, because it's massive titling with all these invasions that take place, is a 20-year process. We studied you, and we went to an area where you have a massive land titling system, which is Alaska. And we went and studied with the Alaska Land Authority, and we're disappointed to find out that you take 16 years, so that was no short-term solution to my country, where one out of every three Peruvians today is voting Marxist-Leninist. But we did find something very interesting in California, which was your land titling insurance system. And we said, now the problem is, of course, we don't have titles. What we have is possessions. Now, can we create a land possession insurance? And we visited the first American land titling insurance company in California and asked this question to their general counsel. And he said, yes, in principle, there should be no problem. So we've been working at this for 30 months. And after 30 months, we have created a model, which we published on the 21st of January as a draft law, which we do every 2 or 3 months with the draft laws we bring out to prove that you can bring capitalism in through legal reform in our countries, and that it's not there yet, and that what's failed is mercantilism and not market economies, because their institutions are not in place, nor the limited liability, nor the contracts, nor the property rights, and especially not the bridges between the banks and the informal sector. And it's based on three pillars, as we call it. It's the bridge between the informal sector and the banks. It's a bridge of three pillars. These are the ads we bring out in the papers. First pillar is a register for possessions. Most informals are organized, and they have their own informal possession registers. The first thing you have to do is find out who owns what, or who has possession of what. So that's the first registration. The second thing is a mortgage, whereby whoever has a possession can mortgage the property over, or the thing that's now being registered, to an insurance company. Thirdly, the insurance company, which can deal with small people, because they can insure a bicycle, to a motorcycle, to an automobile, to a small home, can then give, against its evaluation of how important the property is, an evaluation, say it's $30,000, and can say, okay, I will guarantee you credit up to $20,000. Banks can't do that because they can't deal with micro entrepreneurs. And then the informal can go to the bank and say, I would like a loan of $20,000. And the bank will say, well, what's your collateral? Because it's very hard for me to assess you. And he'll say, here's a AAA insurance company, which has got credit insurance. Now, we published this in the paper thinking there would be another one of our projects which would not get off the ground, in spite of the fact that we had built it with informals, with U.S. insurance companies, that the private insurance companies of Peru had done their evaluations and had agreed to go with it, and that there would be no way for it to get implemented. But it just so happened that our publication of this news, that we developed this project, coincided with a housing crisis. And when we presented to Parliament, we found out something very interesting, which is what we put a point out at the bottom of this ad, which was that parliamentarians all the way from the Communist Party, running through APRA, Mr. Garcia's party, to the right wing, supported the project. And it is now in Parliament as a draft law, supported, like most of our projects, by the extreme left, which are the people who actually deposit these projects in Parliament. I should say that we've got something like 8 draft laws in Parliament, most of which have been put in there at the initiative of the Communist Party of Peru. Now, the interesting thing about this is that Garcia also at that time ran out of funds, because Garcia's enormous popularity in Peru has been based on the fact that he's taken $200 million worth of reserves and actually thrown them at the people of Peru. He's now run out of them. He's got no credit. And he had nationalized banks, promising to democratize credit. Or he said that the reason he was nationalizing banks was to democratize credit. And his legislative powers to do so ran out on the 12th of April. And here he was finalizing nationalization of banks, but he had not democratized credit. So dramatically, 2 days after we presented with our proposal to public opinion with parliamentarians, that is to say, on the 10th of April, on the 9th of April, Garcia calls us to Government Palace and says, I'd like to hear what your project's about. We studied it. We'd like to find out if it's airtight. We explain what it's all about. And on the 10th of April, this project is law. You'll find it that it's brought up in the Financial Times. It's in the major financial papers, and it's front page news, of course, in Peru. What it will do for Peru is pretty extraordinary. First of all, it will involve that most of these possessions will become private property, very quickly indeed, and that's what these people want. Secondly, it means that the first year alone, according to both our calculations and those of government, we will be giving these people $107 million worth of credit. And that 4 years from now, they will have $2 billion of credit from the central system. One percentage point of the total credit market of Peru. We're in fact going to 25% with no money from you. We can actually give our poor more credit simply by doing internal legal reforms. But to do that, it was important that Garcia run out of money. Now, what we have essentially done, if you want to, is we have started identifying, what's very important here, is that we have started identifying a new social class. The informals of the black market is not simply a journalistic trick. It responds to serious studies. Social classes do exist. One of the reasons why Marxists are extremely efficient is because they had discovered, like Jung did, that there is such a thing as a collective subconscious. That you cannot always address people according to their individual desires, but that people collectively, together, do coincide on certain themes, and they feel strong as a result of them. This is the reason why something so inefficient as Marxism has been able to take over half of the world. Their techniques, their marketing techniques to get into power are excellent. They have found out that people, when they feel exploited, have a tendency of going together, that there is such a thing as a common sense, what we prefer to call common sense rather than class consciousness, and it works. And that's the only thing that explains why inefficient Marxists have gotten into power, because that part they're efficient at. So what we've done with the informals is essentially identify Peru's, and probably the rest of Latin America's, burgeoning capitalist class, and address them also in terms of their collective interests. In other words, what Marx said was correct, but who said it had to necessarily be a proletarian class? Because if you analyze the informals, in fact, they're not receiving salaries. So there's no such thing as a capitalist class which is exploiting a large proletariat, which in turn is exploited to the fact that its surplus value goes to the capitalist class. Most of Latin Americans are working for profits today. The important thing is to be able to address them as such. And the important thing is to get the right vocabulary to address them as such. In other words, do your Marxist class analysis correctly. We had, for example, a small survey in Peru, which we did with the 80 most important informal entrepreneurs of the city, which took us about 3 years to identify. These were the most important capitalists of the informal sector. And we asked them all, after having identified them, a series of standard questions, three of which were the following. Are you the private sector? And the reply, 79 out of 80, was no. So we said, are you the public sector? And they said, of course not. The public sector is government. So we said, then who is the private sector? And the reply was, los de arriba, those up there, the oligarchy. In other words, one of the first important things to realize when working in developing countries, that there are cultural problems, but of a different sort. The word private sector has been taken by communism and has been made into a bad word. Capitalism is a bad word. It makes no sense to go in and rescue bad words. If they've taken away certain words, create new words. That's what we've done with the informals. Basically, informals means poor capitalists, or if you want to, entrepreneurs without opportunities. It is not proletarians without salaries. It is entrepreneurs without opportunities, with low profits. We are countries that are cases of rich bureaucrats and poor entrepreneurs. Now, when we've given this kind of message across, we're starting to get these kind of results in Peru. Like I said, most of our laws are being taken by the Communist Party and processed into parliament, with the backing, of course, of the right. But they're sensitive to class analysis. And what's interesting, of course, is that they realize where the votes are. And a successful politician, the first thing a communist wants to do is be a successful politician. He does not want to be an unsuccessful communist. So gradually, we're starting to infiltrate them. And the way we do it is that every project like this one, which I've just indicated to you, we hold public hearings. We've learned from your system of holding public hearings. And we call for signatures. For example, this last project on credit went in with 580,000 signatures. Our previous one went in with 300,000 signatures, where basically we appeal to their class interests as small capitalists. But we don't use the word capitalist, and we don't use the word private. We use the word informals, which is a nice way of saying that you're outside the law. And it's been working. In other words, I think it's very important, when we get together to talk about ideology, to also, when we see the failures in Central America and the dangers running in Central America, and the ones that we're going to have in Peru very soon, because one out of every three Peruvians, we're the next Nicaragua, one out of every three Peruvians is already voting communist, is to realize not only that we're right, but to also realize why we have failed, and why communism has more appeal with the poor. And the reason that occurs is because there is tremendous social injustice in our countries. And if we don't build alternative programs of a capitalist sort, but alternative programs to produce social change, all we're doing is essentially repeating what you're saying here. And we must realize that this involves enormous intellectual research. It involves enormous effort, as Mr. Chafwin said. And that is why he called for support in this direction, which is absolutely true. Because we have to build that ourselves. You are in no condition to teach us. You have grown up spontaneously. You don't even know how you got there. You don't know the value, for example, if an American professor comes to Latin America and he'll talk about democracy, he'll be perfectly satisfied to know their elections are not elections. Well, we know in Latin America that elections don't count that much. You can elect a dictator every so much time. If you have no accountability, if 99% of the laws in the country are actually issued by the executive branch without any controls, without any common law, without any primaries of the people who have actually held them, without comment and notice periods, without hearings, without cost-benefit analysis, with newspapers who get their paper from a state monopoly and who get 40% of their advertising from the state, it's not the same thing to have a democracy in Latin America as to have a democracy in the United States. So unless these reforms take place, it cannot occur. Yet when you ask an American professor what he thinks of democracy in Latin America, he'll probably never even touch rulemaking. And rulemaking is really the most important aspect of your democracy, that you make your rules together and you're accountable for bad rules, which does not exist in our countries, which is why even right-wing legislators fail in Latin America, because they have no way of feeding back into the public. When you ask somebody, for example, in Latin America, if he had thought of limited liability as one of the reasons, or the lack of access to limited liability as one of the reasons for underdevelopment in Latin America, he probably will not have thought of it. But try and think of what it means for an informal entrepreneur to actually operate, because it takes 289 days to get a corporation that has limited liability, with totally exposed liability. If he fails, he loses everything. I mean, think of your own businesses and your own corporations. What would happen if in every venture your liability were not limited? That's an enormous invention. You're not even conscious of it. You not only have that, insurance. You have no way of spreading risks. Corporations, you have no way of spreading profits or risks. Without these tools, long-term contracts that can be honored, without letters of credit, without courts that can actually assure swift justice in case, or the due compensation in case your rights have been violated, without torts, there's no such thing as private property. One of the reasons nationalizations take place in Peru, and unpunished, and they're even popular, is simply because business has negative externalities, enormous negative externalities. We already have, for example, 95% of our transport system in Peru privatized. You talk about it, I see brochures from the Heritage Foundation saying how to privatize the transport system. We've done it. We've had it like that since the beginning, and it doesn't work. And the reason it doesn't work is because if you get run over by a bus, there's no way that you can get compensated for that, because they've had to corrupt all the police stations and all the courts to be where they are in the first place. There's no torts law. And if you don't have torts laws to protect you from negative externalities, private business is bound to be unpopular. At least if it belongs to government, one way or other, you can have influence on the politicians. In other words, without a revolution in institutions in the first place, without drawing of a blueprint of how you actually got there, which is something you don't even know yourselves, we're not going to be able to really learn from you to provide the right institutions. We will one day get into power, and we won't be able to hold power, because that's occurred as well. Anyhow, this is to tell you that we're making advances, as Alex Chafwin says, in Latin America. There are more institutions studying this. There are a lot of problems, and it's very nice to know that you're listening to us during all this time. Thank you.